Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And for those that are joining us live, if you'd like to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room with the usual suspects. If there's an observation you would like to share during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for us to ask our guest, and it doesn't seem like we're heading that direction, that'd be a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we would enjoy bringing in your questions into the conversation. And if you have to run off at some point during the show and you would like to catch up with what you missed, or you just wanted to catch up on some previous episodes of Midrats, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or take the shortcut, head on over to iTunes, and subscribe to the free podcast. Enough of that, though. Let's get back on with the show. We're real excited today, not just about our topic, but also our guest, as we end the last quarter of calendar year 2015, we go into fiscal year 16. Let's look at where one of our favorite topics, China, is heading. And we'll start off our conversation looking at not just some of the bold-faced items you may have seen recently in a lot of the national security press about what China's been up to, but maybe dig in a little bit deeper into some of the peripheral issues that we see in Westpac that both directly and indirectly going to impact how the United States and their allies work with China or work around China going through 2016. And our guest for the full hour to discuss this will be Dr. James Kraska. Dr. Kraska is a professor in the Stockton Center for the Study of International Law, where he previously served as the Howard S. Levy Chair of International Law from 08 to 13. He got his JD from Indiana University in Bloomington, Morey School of Law, and a JSD and LLM from the University of Virginia School of Law. He's also completed a master's degree at the School of Politics and Economics, Claremont Graduate School. James, welcome to Midrats.
Hi, thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
We really appreciate you taking an hour this Sunday to come in and talk with us and just kind of set the scene for those listeners who may be under the age of 45. They may not fully appreciate what everybody's using the long-term freedom of navigation operations, or what we used to talk about all the time back in the day, good old FONOPS. And that's one of the above-the-fold issues that we've seen, especially in the second half of 2015, involving China and the Westpac. If you could, for the listener, outline for them a bit the history of freedom of navigation operations and why this is start to come to the fore once again, especially when it comes to the South China Sea.
Sure, I'm glad to. This is it's a really compelling issue. So really the foundation for the contemporary, you could say the contemporary law of the sea, or even the contemporary world order, is freedom of access for the global maritime spaces, and that includes under the water, the surface of the water, as well as the airspace. And so the foundation, really, for the law of the sea is this concept that used to be called freedom of the seas and is now sort of the more contemporary term is freedom of navigation. And it really emerged from or solidified from Hugo Grotius, who was a jurist in the Dutch Netherlands in the late 1500s and early 1600s, who wrote a brief in a legal case against the Portuguese and the Spanish over the seizure of a vessel, a carrack that was traveling in the Straits of Malacca. And Portugal and Spain at the time were allied, and the Dutch Republic was in rebellion against Spanish rule. And so when the Dutch seized the ship, the Portuguese, it was a Portuguese carrack, and it was a very wealthy prize seizure. So it had a lot of porcelain from China on board, and it multiplied by several times the wealth of the Dutch East India Company that had been operating really the first modern corporation. And so this was not just a sort of an insignificant seizure, but it was a really valuable valuable boarding and seizure of this vessel. So the Portuguese ship was taken all the way back to the Netherlands, and it went before a prize court. And in the prize court, the lawyer for the Portuguese said, well, you can't take our ship because under the Treaty of Tordesillas and the Treaty of Saragossa between Spain and Portugal, they had divided up the oceans about a century beforehand. And so all of the area surrounding Africa and the Indian Ocean belonged to Portugal, and then everything from Brazil onward throughout the Pacific to the Philippines belonged to Spain. And Hugo Grotius challenged this based upon natural law, saying that just the God-given right of everybody to traverse the seas, or this concept of freedom of the seas, meant that Portugal could not have a lawful title to this maritime space. So that doctrine, that's the history of it, and the doctrine persisted for 500 years, and for much of that time, it was accepted in international law by most states that coastal states might claim a 3 nautical mile territorial sea, extending out into the water 3 nautical miles, and that really continued through World War I and through World War II, and then after World War II, and actually a little before World War II, and particularly after World War II, there accelerated a movement to broaden that claim and to make other additional claims into the maritime space. And as those additional claims were made over the maritime space by coastal states, it started to bump up against the right of other countries to enjoy the global commons. In 1979, as the United States was one of the major participants in the third UN conference on the law of the sea to develop an omnibus comprehensive rule set for the oceans, during this conference, which lasted from 1973 to 1982, it became apparent that a number of states were making claims that were viewed as inconsistent with international law, and that's what lawyers say to be polite. What they really mean is that they were unlawful or illegal in international law. So in 1979, the Carter administration dealt with the issue, which had been brewing for about 15 years, of making what they called sailing challenges, or challenges against these excessive or unlawful claims. And so that's the inception for the Freedom of Navigation program, which is governed by a classified presidential decision directive that's still in effect.
Let's talk a little bit about China for a second, because at one point China was a fairly strong sea power, but then they turned inward. And that has an impact on where we are today. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, China was a strong sea power, but it was in the early modern era. So it was really outside of the two major strands of public international law. The first is the contemporary law of the sea and the principle of freedom of the seas, and then the second is the Peace of Westphalia, the two treaties of Osnabrück and Westphalia that sort of resolved the legal architecture for the contemporary world. And what the Peace of Westphalia said is that states would rule internally however they chose, but that they would accept the sovereignty or the boundaries of other states. And this came out of the out of several wars. It ended the 30 Years' War and the 80 Years' War in Europe, and these were principally wars over nationalism as well as a split within Christendom between Catholics and Protestants, and very, very bloody. And so just to be able to end these wars, the states agreed during the negotiations that they would recognize that each principality or each state could be governed by whatever religious rules that they wanted to, and that other states would not sort of interfere in that sovereignty. The problem that China has is that they were really outside of this, and as you mentioned, they did withdraw. And as a result, they became stagnant and weak, and just like Japan did. And Japan was the first to open up, of course, and it quickly began. Japan quickly began to integrate all of the advances that had been made by mostly European states, and China did not. And therefore, that resulted in sort of the idea in China of their 100 years of weakness. They were taken advantage of by a number of countries, including Japan and European countries. They lost their sovereignty in all practical purposes. They had unequal treaties imposed upon them, which meant that European states would require China to open up certain treaty ports in order to trade. And in those treaty ports, the Western powers and Japan actually and Russia actually governed themselves. They had their own courts. They had their own police. Their nationals were not subject to Chinese law. And so this was a great humiliation for China, something that, in my view, they're still not over. And that's a lot, in my view, of what is driving some of Chinese behavior today, is they want to set that historical record right. If you remember, China actually was still a large country. It just couldn't govern itself. So in 1830, China had the largest economy in the world. And yet, for 100 years, more than 100 years after that, it still was in disarray and was subject to the rule of other states, a number of other states. So that really is driving a lot of, I think, what's going on with China. And they have, after the Communist Revolution and the Communists came to power, of course, they focused on sort of making their country whole and eliminating these vestiges of imperialism, such as Hong Kong and, finishing bringing Taiwan back into China. And they've been focused on these, but as they've strengthened and they've resolved all of their land boundaries except the boundary with India, they have, I think, looked to these other areas, these ocean areas, and trying to integrate those sort of into the Chinese state, and China has been accused of being an empire masquerading as a country. Or a civilization, more accurately, masquerading as a country.
It's one thing that I've been trying to get my head around, and you touched on a little bit there, and that has to do with, in the Western context, we have what we think is a certain storyline or a certain storyboard of what was the development of international law and the Law of the Sea, very different than Law of the Sea Treaty, which I still think was a horribly named thing, but what my decision. And a lot, especially coming from the Anglo-Saxon world, where in our background we're thinking common law as opposed to some other legal traditions. And when we're looking at what China is doing in the South China Sea, I'm trying to figure if they're going one of three directions. One direction, if they're just trying to find this gray area in legal law, and I think in one of the articles, it outlines that there's a difference between traditionally how people look and treat a low tide elevation versus rocks, which can't sustain humans, and then there are islands. What happens if somebody transitions from one to the other or from the lowest to the highest rating. And also Stu Belt a few years ago has written, as have others, about trying to, in Westpac, help shape how China goes through lawfare. But that assumes that China has the same respect towards and will play by the same rules that everybody else does that we've traditioned over the years. So with what they're doing with their sand islands in the South China Sea, are they just making a firm stand in a gray area that they're trying to adjust, set a new precedence, or are they trying to put down a pretty strong hand to negotiating, or do we really have a good idea of which way they're actually trying to go as they put everybody in a quandary?
Well, I think China is trying to extract an exception that applies only to China, as based upon what they believe are historical presence in the South China Sea. Law is consisting of rules as well as facts, and I would say that in this case, neither the rule nor the facts fit China's vision or China's historical claims. So they weren't any more present in these areas than anybody else. They don't meet the legal definition for acquisition of sovereignty over the territories, even the largest features, which you might really, there's only one, Itu Aba, that you might say is a no kidding island that can sustain human habitation, because that typically in the law means that it has a natural freshwater source. And so Itu Aba, which is occupied right now by Taiwan, does meet that definition. None of the other features meet that definition. At best, they are rocks, which might have a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. And of course, an island that can sustain human habitation is entitled to generate a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. Low tide elevations are, if they are beyond the territorial sea of a natural large island such as Palawan Island or a mainland coastline, are not entitled to any territorial sea at all. And many of these features are indeed low tide elevations. And then, of course, a number of the features are just submerged features, in which case all they are is part of the seabed, and they're owned, their ownership, so to speak, or actually sovereign rights, is governed by the coastal state on whose continental shelf they lie. And in this case, it's going to be Malaysia, Vietnam, or the Philippines. But there really is no, even those countries do not have lawful sovereignty over the seabed beyond their whatever they're entitled to for a territorial sea. They have sovereign rights and jurisdiction for economic purposes. So that's the problem. Now, as far as the changes that have gone on in these seven or eight features that China has built on, the law will look only at the features in their natural state. The problem here, of course, is that the natural state has now been irrevocably changed, and therefore the evidence has been tampered with, and how do you now go back and try to make that determination? But ultimately, China has offered a number of theories, principally based upon their historical presence in the area, but none of them despite sort of making Chinese people or civilization feel good or strengthening the hand of the government with regard to controlling its people or offering a narrative that helps to further put behind the time of humility or humiliation, it doesn't meet the checklist that's included in the law. So it's just an assertion. And I think they know this. I mean, the whole world has, there's just been a cacophony of rejection of their lawful claims, but China has marched ahead anyway. And the reason is not because they are trying to fulfill the requirements of the law. The reason is because I think the Chinese Communist Party is offering something to the people of China that will strengthen the hand of the party. And it's interesting that this came about now China has had these claims, but they've been fairly ambiguous or amorphous, and China has never really pressed them in the modern time, with two exceptions. They did invade the Paracels in 1974 and killed more than 50 Vietnamese soldiers that were there, and this was right at the time that South Vietnam was collapsing. And then they also occupied Mischief Reef that was claimed by the Philippines in 1995. But except for that, they had not made any sort of overt moves. Their move came in 2009, and I don't think that that's just by happenstance. I think it follows the collapse of world economic growth and the Great Recession in 2008. And so what happened was Malaysia and Vietnam made a submission to the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf, which is a separate, independent body, international organization that was created by the Law of the Sea Convention. And it's a technical organization composed of scientists that are authorized to issue what are called final and binding recommendations for states that are claiming part of the continental shelf. And Vietnam and Malaysia had submitted such a claim to the commission, and the commission received that claim. And then China in 2009 submitted in protest their so-called nine-dash line, which said that Malaysia and Vietnam were encroaching upon an area over which China has indisputable sovereignty and sovereign rights and jurisdiction. So I think that's you know, it's opportunistic for China. It's also, you know, it's a way for China to in an era where they may not be able to continue to meet the economic metrics that they need to meet in order to maintain their popularity and their legitimacy. It's a way to shift that narrative to something else and to sort of feed nationalism.
Now, the Chinese also point to Mahan and the Manifest and the Monroe Doctrine has some support for their position in this area. And can you kind of discuss that in the context of the sea lines of communication that run through the South China Sea?
Sure. Well, you know, so the Monroe Doctrine is not really a legal doctrine. I mean, it was a strategic doctrine. And so I think it's best evaluated on that basis. What I would say there is that, you know, the irony of all this is that China is going to be very frustrated because there are a lot of differences between the emergence of the United States, say, a century ago, and the emergence of China now as a major world power. The United States established the Monroe Doctrine at a time when it was very difficult for any other powerful country to intercede in South America or in the Caribbean. The British had some naval power projection, but for the most part, I mean, it was fairly difficult for European powers to be able to compete with the United States. Also, the states in South America themselves were very weak, even though most of them were by this time independent, but they were very weak. They did not really have a presence on the global stage. That's very different from how Southeast Asia is today, because although China is powerful, it's surrounded by relatively powerful countries as well. Japan is very powerful. Vietnam is not, you know, a small country. These countries are not as weak as Cambodia or Laos would be, the countries in the interior. Even the Philippines is quite a weak country. But on the other hand, they have their ace in the hole, which is a defense relationship with the United States. And then all of these countries are receiving weapons from benefactors. Vietnam has received submarines from Russia, for example. So there is there are some major differences, I think, in that these countries are already vibrant and growing. And also the world is smaller than it was 100 years ago. So things that China is doing in the South China Sea are just going to attract more attention and more outside influence, or what they view as interference, than what the United States could manage. This results really in what a lot of Chinese like to say, which is it's not fair. And that's sort of a constant refrain, and I think that it really sort of underscores the Chinese psychology in this, which is they think that they've been sort of unfairly put upon, which they were historically. I don't think they are today. I don't think they have been since probably 1949. But they still continue to say that the rules that were developed in the Law of the Sea are unfair, that they didn't have an appropriate role. And that's not that doesn't match with the historic record, because China was really a leader in the non-aligned movement during the negotiation for the Law of the Sea Convention. China intervened regularly, made a number of proposals. A lot of the things that China believes now were proposed during the conference, the third UN conference, to be included in the Law of the Sea Convention, and they were not accepted by the majority of states. China had a very active role because both the Soviet Union and the United States were on the same side of most of these issues. The USSR and the United States, along with the United Kingdom, France, and Japan, formed a bloc of five countries called the Major Maritime Powers. And they were in opposition to the Group of 77 and the non-aligned states, which was led principally by China, also by India. But China was really the main coastal state representative. So China did have a very significant role in crafting and shaping the Law of the Sea. But now they sort of want to distance themselves and say that it doesn't that it needs to have adjustments in order to be fair.
Eagle One, I had a little bit of problems with the next question. Yours, or was it over to me?
Oh, it's over to you.
Okay,
you can't think of one. In which case, I'll ask another one.
No, I had one, and actually, it flows into what we were just talking about. With the moves that China has made, we know that a lot of their neighbors, especially their weaker neighbors, have decided to increase how they work together with the U.S. But as we talk about doing actual freedom of navigation operations, who is looking to possibly sail with us? Or is this another situation that has seemed to be very common, that regardless of where we are on the globe when it comes to freedom of navigation, it winds up being a U.S. Navy affair? Are there other nations that do FONOPS like we do, or is this a role that we have just been stuck in for a few decades that everybody assumes that we will do on their behalf?
Well, as part of a formal program, it's the latter. There's no other country that formally does freedom of navigation operations. The British used to. There are some countries that do make diplomatic protests. So the freedom of navigation program has three elements. The first is military to military engagement. The second are diplomatic protests. And the third are the actual operations, the actual transits of ships and aircraft. There is no country that does the third. Although even the U.S., has operations which look like FON operations but are not part of the FON program. So the FON program is intended to be a interagency U.S. Department of Defense, Department of State program where you look at places that countries that have excessive claims and then how those claims will be challenged. It's unknown at the unclassified level exactly what these two institutions have agreed upon today. But my suspicion is that all or almost all of the of the operations which are reported as freedom of navigation operations are really, you can call them that, but they're probably not part of the FON program. My guess is that they are just routine DoD operations. And the point is that other countries make similar routine operations that happen to go into areas that other countries may claim, but they don't do it as part of a formal program. Now, what is the benefit if you're going to still do the operation? That you're still sort of making the point. That's true, except the FON program does two things, at least for the U.S., is it signifies that there's agreement within the U.S. government at the highest level, at the secretarial level, of what ought to be done or the importance of the oceans. And then the second thing is that it creates an official record. So if another country, such as Japan or Australia or India, has another process for doing that and they have an official record, then that would be beneficial. They do not have a website like U.S. FON operations are published by the Global Security Affairs in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And those operations include operations that are both in the FON program as well as other operations which are routine Department of Defense operations, which may or may not be in the actual FON program, because the law allows the Department of Defense to operate in any area over which the U.S. In accordance with the law of the Sea Convention over which the U.S. is entitled to operate under the law. And so, it gets into internal DoD clearances and interagency clearances as far as who's actually approving a certain operation.
Does the fact that the U.S. is not a signatory to the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea cause us any particular problems with China and other countries?
Well, it's certainly a talking point China has used. Other countries have used it. It's harmed us in some ways. For example, Malaysia or Indonesia have declined to participate in the Proliferation Security Initiative, and they've cited the fact that the U.S. is not a party to the Law of the Sea Convention. Of course, the U.S. says that that all of the navigational provisions in the Law of the Sea reflect customary international law, and therefore those provisions are binding on all countries anyway, and therefore the U.S. doesn't have to join. Other countries, such as Iran, have claimed that, well, because this is a treaty, you can't have the benefits of the treaty unless you also are bearing the costs, and therefore you're only entitled to these rights as a quid pro quo in exchange for other countries. I mean, there's some rationale, actually, for that. I mean, that's not a ridiculous way of thinking, because normally you don't get the benefits of a treaty unless you also commit to the bearing the costs of that treaty. The U.S. position is that, well, all of these are reflective of customary international law, and that customary international law is just as legally binding, it's just as valid as any other source of international law, just like treaty law. The problem is customary international law is somewhat amorphous. It's not written down anywhere that's completely authoritative. So there can be reasonable differences over what might be custom and state practice that's governed by law and what is not. So the U.S. is in a weaker position, I think, without being a party to the Law of the Sea Convention. On the other hand, don't expect South China Sea nirvana, the clouds to open and the sun to shine and everything be okay if the U.S. were to join. China is not going to change their unlawful claims just because the United States joins the Law of the Sea. So it will be more of a diplomatic issue. It will remove one obstacle and a potential embarrassment for the United States. It will give the United States a stronger hand. But it's very difficult to measure to say that, that there will be some sort of concrete change.
As everybody who was a young kid back in the great Cold War era, you know, one of the common things that everybody learned to understand and live with at sea, because how close we would interact with them throughout the globe, and we didn't want anything besides the occasional friendly shouldering to lead to anything unnecessary, was the incident at sea agreement that we had with the Soviet Union. As China now, we don't just find her in the South China Sea with that huge auxiliary coast guard they have all over the place, but the Chinese Navy is now not just off of Africa. She's regularly going into the Med. She's even in the North Atlantic. And this will continue to grow as her Navy and her global interests do. There have been some discussions of going forward with an incident at sea agreement with China. Do you share that that would be a logical good step to go? And do you think that might be something we might be able to achieve in order to mitigate any local area commanders perhaps misinterpreting what the other side is doing?
Well, I guess I'm a little skeptical of the value of an incidents at sea agreement type of agreement with China. In fact, you may know my colleague, Raul Pete Pedroso, he and I are working on an article now that discusses the annex to the recent the 2014 Memorandum of Understanding between the U.S. and China on rules of behavior for safety of air and maritime encounters. And so there is already a movement in that direction. And I'll tell you why we're skeptical. But first of all, I'll lay out what has already been agreed to. There are three different instruments. The first is a notification of exercises, and then the second is a rules of behavior, and then the rules of behavior is principally for surface maritime encounters and subsurface maritime encounters. And then the third is an annex, which was just completed during the recent visit of President Obama and President Xi in the United States, and that is focused on air-to-air interactions. And so all three of these are sort of INCSI-type agreements. Now, the notification of exercises, it's a political issue. It's, I guess I have less to say about that. I wouldn't necessarily have signed it, but it's probably not as pressing. I mean, the downside from a law of the sea perspective is that the U.S. worked hard to ensure that transit passage and innocent passage and high sea in the territorial sea and international straits, and then high seas freedoms in the exclusive economic zone. We worked hard to ensure, both in the treaty text of the Law of the Sea Convention as well as in state practice, that coastal states could not demand prior notification or require seeking consent for the exercise of navigational rights. To me, the notification agreement, although it doesn't explicitly say that you would have to notify, I mean, that's the name of it. That's certainly what China intends, is that now that they will have greater notice, and if they have greater notice over things that are not required in the law, obviously it's a political issue, but it tends to erode those norms, in my view. Now, the notification, the MOU for rules of behavior in the maritime domain, all they really do is cite heavily to the Law of the Sea Convention and the collision regulations. So there is not any additional law. There are not even any new norms in the rules of behavior. They just reflect what already exists. So I'm not really sure why you need a new document if, you know, since you already have, for example, the collision regulations, which do apply to both military vessels, warships, as well as civilian vessels, including all of the maritime militia and the Coast Guard that you mentioned, that China has a vast and growing fleet. So the collision regulations already apply. There's already the obligation to sail or steam with due regard. And so I don't know what more you get out of a rules of behavior. You draw China's attention to their existing obligations, but I don't know if you need a treaty to do that. What China gets is they get some political sense of equality, that they have sort of displaced the Soviet Union in a bipolar world, and I think that's what they sort of longed for, and that's why they wanted it. Now we have the air agreement that was recently signed, and there again, there is no new law, and there are no new norms. It's already a norm. Certainly, it's mentioned in the International Civil Aviation Organization rules that are promulgated regularly, that military aircraft should have due regard. It's in the treaty, the Moscow Treaty of 1944, that they have due regard for civil aircraft, and it's mentioned in their subsequent statements that military aircraft should have due regard for one another. So there's not anything new in that either. There's a sort of a political benefit that China accrues. Now, you could say the U.S. accrues maybe some benefit by alleviating concerns among some elements in Southeast Asia that the United States is sort of making too much of this, or this idea that since the United States is not from Southeast Asia, that it's sort of misbehaving. I mean, there's elements in these countries that might sort of tend to side with China. I mean, a lot of these countries have very large Chinese minorities or influential Chinese minorities. So with that, you could say, well, the U.S. is signing this. Maybe there's some sort of tangential benefit there. I wouldn't make that calculation. I don't think that that any of these three agreements are useful or in the interest of the U.S. But there you have it. I mean, that's what's going on. In the end, I do not think that a Inc. C type agreement is useful, because there's a tendency, and it's almost sophomoric, it's what you see in law schools, which is there's a problem, create a treaty. And I don't think that that's what the problem, that's not what's needed in the world today. I mean, there's more than 50,000 treaties. The world is not necessarily better because you do another treaty. The world would be a lot better if existing norms and rules were complied with.
Well, that's always the rub with international law, is who's going to enforce the law if it's violated. We have this picture, and I don't know if it's just a media issue or it's in fact, but we have this seemingly overly aggressive Chinese efforts to force people in and out of areas of the South China Sea. You don't want them to go. We start with the EP3 incident back in, well, I guess how long ago it was. We had the near misses recently. We've had the air warnings over the flying over some of these islands. We've had the shouldering another harassment of the USNS Impulse, Impeccable and Victorious. Is this? And you had this article recently on the Diplomat suggesting we should treat China like it treats us. Is this what you were talking about? Should we be as aggressive and continue to drive through these areas as we were once? Or is there something else you had in mind with that article?
Well, the article was just intended to remind people of what the Reagan statement on the law of the sea actually said. So the Reagan statement of 1983 said that the U.S. would not sign the law of the sea, but that we would comply or recognize the rights of other states in waters off their coasts as reflected in the convention. And this has become an article of faith throughout the U.S. government and throughout the world. Countries expect the United States to comply. But I just think it's interesting to go back and look at what just a fresh look at what Reagan said in the statement. And what he said was that the U.S. would comply so long as the rights and freedoms of the United States and other countries and others under international law are recognized by such coastal states. And that has always been forgotten. The United States affords all of the rights and privileges in the Law of the Sea Convention to countries that do not comply with the convention. And so the diplomat piece, what would Reagan do about China's violation of the Law of the Sea, that I put out, it was a week ago, October 19th, was just a reminder that there is this caveat there that the U.S. has uniformly failed to implement. And it's a more of a thought piece of whether that's a good idea. Is there some benefit to treating other countries as they treat us? So, for example, just recently, right before the Xi Obama summit, the PLA Navy sent a flotilla of 5 warships through the territorial sea of one of the Aleutian Islands in the U.S. territorial sea of one of the 50 states, not a territory but a state. And the United States didn't harass them. They didn't challenge them. They didn't say didn't have a right to be there. The United States didn't purport to require prior notification or prior consent. Didn't do low overflies. As far as I know, was not following them, at least not on the surface. So that's a very different reaction from what you would get from the United States going within 12 nautical miles, of China. In fact, except for these islands, quote-unquote islands or features in the South China Sea, I can't tell you when the last time was that the United States sent a warship within 12 nautical miles of China proper, meaning mainland China or Hainan Island. I think it's been decades. And yet, if the United States were to do so, it would be on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, because China would make an enormous protest. They would be apoplectic. I mean, they would go bananas. So the point of the article is just this disparity, and that it doesn't seem that what we've been doing has been effective. And so the article is food for thought on whether there's a benefit of changing how we do things.
Well, in the international scene, weakness is rarely a successful strategy to transmit. Let's do a little think bit here. If we make the decision that we do want to do FON ops, there's a broad spectrum of how to do it. Our co-host here mentioned a little bit ago, sending a USNS ship is at one end of the spectrum, which is a weak signal and also very, very vulnerable. On the opposite end of the spectrum, you have what we did with Libya and the Gulf of Sidra off the 80s with carriers, very provocative in that. When you look at that spectrum and our lack of doing this with China, what would be the right way to make a statement with China that would give them the least amount of running room to raise a stink? Is it air? Is it surface? And is it surface, is one carrier the right way to go, 4 carriers, a couple of destroyers? What can make the point effectively while at the same time mitigating any possible risk of overreaction, do you think?
Well, I mean, what did China do? They sent a flotilla of 5 warships. I mean, there were 3 or 4 shooters and one large supply ship. I mean, so that's what they decided to do. I don't know why the United States would be reluctant to do anything less. I mean, if you are, if you're always worried about if you're self-deterred because you're worried about an overreaction, then you've ceded that ocean space. So, you know, if we've gotten to that point, then that's the way it is. It's certainly not good for the United States or for international law or for this liberal world order that we've tried to create. So my thought is that if you cannot send a flotilla of 5 surface warships into the Chinese territorial sea off mainland China or Hainan Island, then the U.S. is already self-deterred based upon these overreactions that China has done.
Well, and that raises the issue that you've also noted some other places. We've already, for a couple of weeks now, if not longer, we've been talking about a freedom of navigation something through the South China Sea near these islands and other areas, and it seems to be under consideration by the White House, although I think you pointed out that the freedom of navigation stuff dates back to 79 or so. Why is it taking this particular administration so long to do what most of us now think ought to be done?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, if the press reports, I mean, there was a political report. All I know is what's in the media. I mean, if the political reported perhaps a month ago that Admiral Harris, the U.S. PACOM commander, had some disagreements with the White House over the conduct of freedom of navigation operations. If indeed that's true, what it underscores is a weakness in the White House. It's not just the Obama White House, though. If it's true, it also would extend to the Bush and the Clinton White House, because the freedom of navigation program was quite robust in the 80s and early 90s. And then, for several reasons, it really has atrophied. The first is that the U.S. force structure declined, and so therefore it's harder to get ships and aircraft in far-flung areas. The second is that during the Clinton administration, the oceans policy issues within the White House moved from the National Security Agency to the Council on Environmental Quality, or CEQ. And CEQ is the White House level office for environmental management. And so what happened is that the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration began to control strategic U.S. oceans policy, and the National Security Council took a back seat. And that has persisted throughout the Clinton administration and then into the Bush administration. The Bush administration did not fix it. It should have, but they did not, and it continues now with the current administration. So, you know, you have some structural problems there that would have to be solved. But it's certainly, from the media, it looks as though U.S. PACOM and from the comments that I've seen in the media from Admiral Swift, that they are interested and prepared to conduct freedom of navigation operations if they are given the go-ahead. It has not, whatever the reason, it hasn't been helpful from a from a law of the sea standpoint, because it looks uncertain and it looks vacillating, and it also, the biggest problem is that it has drawn a huge amount of sort of unwanted attention toward a program that is intended to be soft spoken. It's intended to be not sneaky, but also not provocative. And now, if there are freedom of navigation operations, they can't help but be provocative, because it's been built up and there's been this war of words, and it is completely the opposite of how the FON program has operated. In a way, the U.S. has put itself into a box, I think, by vacillating. If they're not going to do the freedom of navigation operations, then they should have just shut up. If they're going to do them, they should do them. But the FOM program was never designed with this. Now they've sort of added this fourth element, which is hand-wring about it for a long time before you either do or don't do it. Now, if we do it at this point, it will be more provocative and more difficult than if we had just done it long ago, or if we had continued to do it throughout the 90s and the 2000s. If we had continued to do them, they would be seen as routine. And to the credit of PACOM, there are operations which are routine. For example, SRO, strategic reconnaissance operations, are routine. You don't hear about them. They occur very commonplace. And you could consider those as freedom of navigation operations, even if they're not part of the FON program. So those sort of ongoing operations are, and also the military survey operations, I think those are very helpful, because as soon as you stop doing something, if you want to start it up again, then it is regarded as provocative. And that's where we seem to be now with sort of formal FON operations or FON challenges.
Yeah, I think you hit on the most important part of that discussion right now is talking about it too much and not having done for a while just adds to the potential of it becoming something nobody really wants it to be. We also, we just have about 4 minutes left in the show. You mentioned something early on in the show that kind of ties into what a few people have written about recently about China and her near abroad. And that has to be, you know, where is she on that spectrum of empire to nation and a culture? And a lot of her neighbors have significant Chinese minorities. Thailand has the largest, not much potential conflict there, but in Malaysia, just under Thailand on the number of ethnic Chinese there. And there is a history of ethnic Chinese being the victim of, for lack of a better phrase, pogroms there and riots. There's been issues in Indonesia as well. What type of movement has China made of late to try to exert some type of responsibility, or does she feel like she has any type of responsibility on behalf of the ethnic Chinese in her near abroad?
Wow, that's an interesting question. You're right. So Malaysia is about half Malay and then about a quarter Chinese. Singapore also has, it's about the reverse. It's about more than half Chinese and then half everything else, primarily Malay and Indian. You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that there are probably some Sinologists that might be better prepared to address that issue. But certainly we can see from the force structure that China has developed that they certainly have the power projection capability that they did not have, and that they've actually exercised in removing people from places like Lebanon, and Syria. So, and as you mentioned, their operations in the Mediterranean. So they certainly have, you know, an ability to project power. I think that the overseas Chinese are also a potential source of influence within the governments in some of these countries as well. And you mentioned Malaysia. Malaysia has always felt that it's had a, quote, special relationship with China. Now that's starting to crumble because Chinese warships are are patrolling along the Laconia Shoals, which are in Malaysia's exclusive economic zone, and that has made Malaysia worried. And I think over the last 4 or 5 years, Malaysia has unfortunately understanding that this special relationship doesn't extend as far as ensuring their offshore maritime space from Chinese encroachment.
Yeah, I've got a question that will last about 5 minutes to answer. We focus kind of on the South China Sea, but China's claims are not just there. They're looking at the Senkaku's chain south of Japan. They've also made some assertion, I'm not sure what they base it on, of claims in the Arctic. Are we going to see, do you think, more of these claims? And before we wrap up, I want to thank you for appearing on our show again. Jim, it's always interesting.
Oh, thank you. That's right. They do have claims in the East China Sea. China claims that it is a near Arctic state that has, quote, interests in the Arctic, although that's sort of vague, whatever that means. I think that if at some point, if China and Taiwan combine in some way that you may see further claims on the east side of Taiwan that might bump up against U.S. Claims from Guam. There may be some overlap there. I think, though, that China has already realized that it's bitten off quite a bit, and so they are they're trying to consolidate their current set of claims, and I think that they'll have a lot of difficulty in doing so.
And on that note, we'll go ahead and wind up. A great episode and a great hour. Again, really appreciate you taking time, Jim, to join us this afternoon to talk about China and a bit more. Always wanted to leave people wanting more. What are some of the topics that the listener might expect to see you writing on soon, and where do you think they might be able to find it?
Well, I tend to like The Diplomat because I think that it reaches people that are interested in the Asia-Pacific. And as I mentioned, Pete Pedrozo and I are going to do a piece. We're working on a piece on the aviation MOU. The next shoe to drop, I think, is the ADIZ. So what I see happening is that the United States will indeed conduct FON operation or operations, plural, in that area. And as a result of that, China will use that as an excuse to further militarize the South China Sea and especially to create an ADIZ that will be problematic for free air navigation.
Perfect. Well, we look forward to seeing it, and I hope you have a great week.
Thanks kindly. It was a lot of fun, gentlemen.
Thanks, sir.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. We look forward to talking to you again soon, and until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.